Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory of Music, reminding you that it is Kerner Hall's 10th anniversary concert season. The Toronto Star has said of Kerner Hall, quote, "the greatest venue in the city and magnificent in its acoustics as much as in its design." Every season, there are nearly 100 spectacular concerts by the world's top classical, jazz, roots, and world music artists. Upcoming concerts you should know about: Middle Eastern songwriters Noah and Mira Awad on March 2nd, and the Art of Time Ensemble celebration of Steve Earle. It's titled Doghouse Roses on May 3rd. Kerner Hall is one of the finest concert venues in the world, no matter who is performing. See the lineup at rcmusic.com/performance. Okay, here we go. Welcome, greetings, hello. It is Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders and thinkers speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. My name is Mark Wigmore, and thank you for joining me for this inaugural episode of this inaugural season. I'm very excited, and I'm thrilled to be back with you. If you've listened to me in the past on CBC or Jazz FM 91 or News Talk 1010 or Proud FM, or maybe I'm speaking to you for the first time. Maybe you're curious about the idea behind this podcast and really nothing to do with me, which is entirely possible. And in fact, I welcome that. So either way, thank you for being here. And since we're talking about the idea of this podcast, let's address it for just a moment, because I think it would be a good idea to set the tone here. I've been doing this type of work for a long time. And by work, I mean interviewing people about their creativity and their life experiences, and that whether that be in the arts or in news, I've done a lot of it, 20, 25 years. So that's nothing new. You can Google my name and the word interview, put it all together, and there's lots there to choose from. So here in 2019, I really wanted to continue to speak to these thoughtful and artistic people, but maybe go a little deeper on a few of the big ideas that are rolling around the collective psyche at the moment. Thus the title of this podcast, Art at the End of the World. Now, I've had a few raised eyebrows about where my head is at based on the title of this project, but I'll explain it this way. Do we really think the end of the world is upon us? Is the clock approaching midnight? Are we at some sort of big tipping point here? Well, I think every generation feels that in some sense, some sort of existential dread. Is this it? They must have felt that way during the Industrial Revolution, during world wars, what have you. Everybody gets worried about the state of humanity in their moment. So with that in mind, do I actually think it's the end right now here in 2019? Not really. But it does feel like we are on precarious ground. Am I right? It feels like we're walking a tightrope right now. Every culture or civilization or generation feels a sense of angst. So why is it we're feeling that heightened right now? So I've been asking myself that question, and there are many reasons, but I feel like it's the result of perhaps now our decades-old information age, the advent of technological connectivity, quote-unquote. It was really touted as an advancement, but I don't know that we were really mentally equipped to deal with the onslaught of ideas and politics and ego and narcissism and knowledge that's now at our fingertips. It's sort of paralyzing in a way. The media landscape and the cultural fabric is dividing and it's distilling, and we're left here to sort it all out. Time is accelerating. There's this sense that these bubbles of ideas and politics and culture are fracturing and headed in all different directions. But with all that in mind, even at this moment of info overload, art and creativity still can cut through the noise, and I love it for that. It can still reach the masses somehow. It can still have an effect, and I want to celebrate that here on this podcast. We have fascinated over artists who hold up a mirror to our collective reality for hundreds of years. We've turned to them as translators, as interpreters. So what are those artists saying right now? What are they creating? What are they thinking during these, I guess, dark days? I went and saw that great new documentary the other night, Free Solo, which is fantastic if you haven't seen it. They're showing it in IMAX right now. And I was so inspired. I was so moved. My perspective on the human condition had changed. And I'm sure you've had that experience where you walk out of a movie or a theater performance or a stand-up comedy routine, and you found that you are connecting to the world in a new way. That's a feeling I want to share on this podcast. And despite our title, I actually want this to be a space that can give solace and hope and inspiration. And I want to share that with you. So welcome aboard. It's an adventure. If you're excited about the idea behind this podcast, you can consider supporting it in a very fundamental way. We have four incredible sponsors, including Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory of Music, who you just heard from, Salter Street Brewery, Superframe Framing Services, and Red Eye Media. But you can actually help by becoming a patron of this podcast. How do you do that? Well, you simply head to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/ Art at the End of the World. And you can click on one of the tiers that are available. I think there's $3 and $5 and $10, whatever you like. But a reminder that when you do come in at that $5 mark, I'm sending you a bonus portion of the interview you're going to hear today and access to each episode early, which is great. Patreon.com/Art at the End of the World. And so we're going to start with a really incredible guest for episode one of season one of Art at the End of the World. Britta Johnson, theater superstar, Dora Award winner, and a very thoughtful person. And I'm going to give you some background on Britta in a moment. She is a real story in the theater world. But I will remind you, Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Salter Street Brewery, one of the beer havens in Toronto's East End, and one of my personal favorites, in fact. You can visit Salter Street Brewery just south of Queen Street East near Broadview. They have limited parking, or you get off the 501 streetcar at Queen and Salter and discover this little hidden gem. Salter is made up of a small, passionate team of beer lovers. All the beers are made right there on site. Riverdale Pilsner is the flagship Salter Street beer, which is also available in LCBOs, select beer stores, and some grocery stores. Call in and relax in this cottage vibe brewery, enjoy the great beer, or take some fresh beer to go in their hand-filled howlers or their tallboy cans. Salter Street Brewery is a perfect stop on your East End beer tour. It's dog-friendly, it's available for private events, and features live music on select Saturdays. It's open noon to 9 p.m. every day, 7 days a week. SalterStreetBrewery.com, or check them out on Instagram or Facebook. That's at Salter Street Brewery. Great to have Salter on board. So before we get to Britta Johnson, I would be remiss, I suppose, if I didn't say a few things about the last 6 months for me, especially if you used to listen to me on Jazz FM 91, Jazz and the Arts, as it was formerly known. It's kind of a long story, but I'll try to boil it down here. Many of the interviews that I've conducted over the years were recorded at Jazz FM, and I'm very proud of the work that I did there with our great team. And now, most of us aren't there. For 4 years, I was the arts editor and host of the program Arts Toronto and the morning show host at times. It was really a great experience. I loved that job with all my heart, and then it wasn't a great experience at the end. In my case, I was let go with a group of full-time on-air staff back in June, and this was right after we'd finished fundraising $250,000 for the station. So to be shown the door right after that, you can imagine it was a difficult moment for me personally, but also for the listeners. And it was a confusing time, and it still is. And there was a well-publicized internal investigation into the management and the board of directors and the culture of the workplace environment there. There are various lawsuits going on right now. It's actually kind of a sensational story in its own way. So I certainly didn't want to leave, but that's show business, right? Not my first rodeo. And right after I left, I had a real outpouring of people encouraging me to start something new. And so that's when I came up with the idea for this project. So you can read all about it if you want by simply searching Jazz FM 91 in Google News. You can make your own conclusions, but I have to say I miss it very much. But at the same time, I wouldn't have had a chance to do this exciting podcast without that change. And change is good, no matter what form it comes in. I mentioned this business a moment ago. Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Red Eye Media, an innovator in arts, communications, and media relations for over 15 years. Red Eye Media works with leading film, television, and performing arts organizations to build their audiences and their impact through engaged, passionate, and strategic communication. Some of those companies include Canadian Stage, Crow's Theatre, The Musical Stage Company, Pacific Northwest Pictures, SummerWorks Performance Festival, and the Toronto Dance Theatre. For more information on the power of Red Eye, you can visit redeyemedia.ca. A great team there. All right, enough about this podcast, the MO of it, enough from me. Let's talk about Britta Johnson. She's my first guest here on Art at the End of the World. I got a call from my pal Suzanne about a year and a half ago, and she suggested that I talk to this young musical theater talent, this maven by the name of Britta. And she told me that Britta was something of a prodigy growing up in Stratford, Ontario, which is the home of the famous Stratford Festival, world famous. And her parents both were in the theater business, pit musicians, and the whole scene had sort of worked its way into her soul at a very early age. She was this exciting new talent. She's a composer, a lyricist, a performer, a director, and someone I should consider speaking with. And at the time, she had this new production coming out called Life After. So we got together and we re-recorded it, maybe a little hesitantly on my part. She was only 25 or 26 at the time, and I thought, who's this young talent that they're pushing on me here? It was a short interview, but I was very impressed with everything she had to tell me. She showed a lot of humility and modesty, but at the same time, passion for all that she had learned about musical theater through her growing up in Stratford, being immersed in the culture of musical theater and stage. I also learned that she had experienced some real trauma in her life. She lost her father early on. And I knew that that had something to do with her play Life After. So I was very impressed with that interview. And then Canadian Stage got together with the Musical Stage Company and they put this show on at the Berkeley Street Theater. I went. It was a sold out, I think, opening night. I sat in the back row and I was riveted. What talent. The storytelling, the flow of this particular piece of musical theater, the emotional depth of it. I could see some of Britta's story within the play, but at the same time, I could see she was going beyond her own personal experiences. It was superb, and everybody thought so. It was really a critical darling, and I think they had to put in extra shows, and it really was something special. It went on to win 6 Doras, including one for Britta. Suddenly, she was the talk of the town, and we don't see that often. Here in Toronto or here in Canada. Since then, I've learned about some of her other shows like Brantwood and The Big Box Story, which was her first, and then Dr. Silver, which she's going to talk about that one in a moment, but that was her most recent piece. I was so excited about her success and so impressed with her work that I wanted to get a hold of her and book her as one of the first guests on this program. And she was gracious enough to agree. And not only that, but she agreed to record the interview in her home in downtown Toronto. And we actually sat in her breakfast nook. So you might hear heaters or refrigerators in the background, but that's what happens when you don't have a studio anymore. I just got a couple mics. I'm a mobile guy at this point. So let's head to the breakfast nook together right now. This is my conversation with theater superstar Britta Johnson. You're a big Joni Mitchell fan.
I am, yeah. Now, okay, so I love early Joni.
Right.
And then I did a presentation when I was in university about jazz Joni.
Wow.
And I'm going to be honest, the thing that got me into Joni was that... This is embarrassing, but like her orchestral album, Both Sides Now.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it also gets used at the Olympics in Vancouver.
It did get used at the Olympics in Vancouver.
And when I met Joni Mitchell, she was promoting that record. So that's sort of interesting that That was the one that caught you. Which track?
My dad used to have his big job in our household was doing the laundry in our very unfurnished basement. And he had a big setup down there with like huge speakers and a record player and twinkle lights. And whenever he'd do the laundry, he'd just sit in the basement for like 3 hours and the floor would shake with what he was listening to. And he'd usually listen to kind of weird esoteric jazz. And then he got the record of Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now. Uh-huh. And I remember when that started to come up through the floors.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds.
So the two tracks I like the best on that are Both Sides Now and A Case of You,
right,
which I think are two of the best songs ever written.
I agree.
Ever in the history of time.
Wow.
So that the first time I heard those two songs was on that record. And the arrangements, who was the orchestral arranger on that album? I can't remember.
I want to say it was maybe the same guy that Diana Krall used for some of her stuff.
But I don't know. Yeah. I did it. I talked about it in that presentation in university.
I do know who you mean, though. You're kind of in the concert business in your own way.
Am I?
Do you think?
I don't know. I don't know what that means.
By the way, Britta Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, on the podcast. Excited to have her here. You were one of the first people I thought of when I wanted to put this thing together, so thank you.
Very flattered.
Thank you for taking the time.
Of course.
You have to create an atmosphere with light and sound and music, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You ever think about how that connects to a concert experience?
I mean, I guess so. That's what I like best about writing musicals. It's like you kind of get to create a whole world.
Yeah.
And you very collaboratively, but in the same way, I guess, as constructing a concert. The only difference is that you're not at the forefront of it,
right,
which I find to be a gift.
You're not rocking Freddie Mercury style up front.
Yeah. And I don't have to sing about myself. I can speculate about other people's lives and make them sing about it.
But I would say a great singer-songwriter can do that as well, right?
I mean, like, I guess so.
I mean, I don't know that Joni was always talking about herself, for example.
She talked about herself a lot.
I think she did.
I think she did.
But yeah. like a Bob Dylan or something like that. They're writing, if they're great, they can write about characters and they can also defend some of their,
yeah,
what they're saying when they're saying, well, that's the character.
That's the character.
That's not me.
I mean, I guess that's true. It is. I love songwriting. That's the thing and I like writing songs for musicals in that way. I guess you are right. Like creating a concert, like creating, you know, one evening where people sit down and go through it with you and then they leave, and that's
especially it. I think your last project, right, it had a bit more of a being so as immersive as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Silver, A Celebration of Life. I mean, that was something where it felt more of like a concert than maybe Life After in its own way, just in the sense that there were quite a few people singing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and that's something we talked about a lot, my sister and I, when we were writing it. If we could try to make, well, I don't know. You always want to get new people in the theater. You want to challenge what it means to write a musical. And our favorite, like, concerts are the very best thing to go to, I think.
Right.
Just a live music show. Even though I love stories. I love writing music for a story. But when we were writing Dr. Silver, we wanted it to feel a bit more like a concert. What if we could make it feel a bit more like a rock concert?
And I know that it feels too soon, but the song is written and the song is perfect, and we've always known the tune. We gather here together at the edge of...
What has been a great concert in your life? I mean, you've seen lots of musical theater, you live in that world a lot of the time, but you also, you know, I want to talk about this in a moment too, that you do have this incredible wide, broad spectrum of music that you allow into your life. You must have a couple of concerts that stand out for you.
I guess there are, but
you're kind of a millennial, like, maybe you don't go, it's expensive.
I should go more,
right?
I'm trying to think about in recent memory. Okay, I went to see Leonard Cohen the last time he was in Toronto.
Wasn't that something?
Oh my god, he's like the sexiest man alive.
Showman.
Ever. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it was, and he really amazing. Pulled off a fedora. I didn't know that was possible.
So that was at the ACC?
That was at the ACC. Or
formerly known as the ACC, Scotiabank.
Oh, I didn't even know about the name change. I missed it. Yeah.
You're busy.
Busy, yeah.
But that was incredible. It was like 3 hours, and he kind of went through the entire spectrum of the work. That incredible band. A lot of those band members have been with him since 60s, 70s at Roscoe Beck and the bass player who's the band leader and so on. And you know what's great is that Montreal concert that they did just after he passed. Mm-hmm. If you can watch that on YouTube or something, it gives you the chills.
I'll bet.
There's a tower in the background, and at the top is just a shadow of him in his fedora watching the concert. Oh my God, I was like
spooky.
Total specter. Like yeah. it was something else. But
wow.
Great show.
Yeah, like a religious experience,
totally.
Kind of. And I didn't expect that at the ACC, you know.
Right.
But it felt really intimate and powerful and, yeah. Religious.
Good one. You're a big Leonard fan as well.
I am. I'm not, you know, I'm not as big as I should be, frankly. I that's something I couldn't probably nerd out with you about. But
no?
I have great respect for him.
Yeah, me too. That's a good one. Did you think about that? Because it sort of had like a slight gospel kind of spirit, or should we say a spiritual feel.
Mm-hmm.
When you're putting together Dr. Silver, where once again, it is that spiritual gospel sound on some of it.
It's all there. I mean, we were trying to think, when we were just trying to construct the world of that show, we weren't raised without traditional religion, but in some ways music in our household kind of was a religion. And music is, if anything's going to make me believe in God, I think it would be music. Believe in a higher power. Believe in something bigger than me that I don't understand, but I'm going to get glimpses of. That would be music. And that's what we constructed this world around, is the worship of that and the ritualization of the experiencing music like that. I don't know. Yeah, that's we talked a lot about that when we were making it.
I like the idea that if we had to show the better part of ourselves to an alien race, you know, mm-hmm. coming down to visit planet Earth, that we might want to start with our music, you know.
I would think so. I would agree.
Those great symphonies, the beautiful jazz performances, the incredible musical theater, what we can do.
Yeah. It feels bigger than, it feels just outside of what I know how to talk about.
Right.
And that's what I like about it.
Right. Yeah. Right. I agree. You've had a, you know, I'll remind, if people heard our interview, it was a short little interview we did back in 2017, and it's still out there. But when we talked, you were just about to launch Life After.
Mm-hmm.
And you were excited. I think there was a lot of, you know, suddenly you're doing these interviews and the Canadian stage is ramping up and there's this ad campaign and out it goes. I feel like a lot has changed since that moment when I got thinking about what's happened to your life and your world and your work.
I guess so. Yeah. That was the beginning of something. Maybe it's been a big year. Yeah.
I mean, just to give people a bit of an understanding of what that was, it was a production, I think, for Matthew Jocelyn and Canadian Stage. Was the first time they'd ever done something domestic from the ground up. Where
was it?
Yeah, I believe so. I read that.
I don't know.
Yeah, which was exciting to me because, I mean, he's Mr., you know, lived in Europe and so on and so forth. So for him to kind of say, I really do believe in what I'm seeing here was exciting. But obviously it was a collaboration between several companies. And then it's at the Berkeley. I feel like it more or less sells out. Like they had to extend the run and everything.
They did extend the run, yeah. It was cool.
Felt good, right?
Yeah. It felt amazing. It was an outlandish experience. I don't think I was in my body for any of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So they extend the run, and then when do you find out that, hey, like we're going to actually take it to other places and...
I mean, that was always the goal, I think. We're going to San Diego with it. It's a whole new production, actually, with a whole new creative team, and it's a brand new situation.
It's funny, because they keep saying the word new with Life After, and I feel like for you, you've now watched this thing.
For so long, yeah.
For so long. Yeah. Go through a lot of different iterations, a lot of different rewrites.
But suddenly, I'm out of words. I'm out of words. Suddenly, I'm out of words. I'm out of words, this is bigger and brighter
and brighter than... And it's not like that last one was bare bones. I mean, you had a big band on stage, you had all sorts of talented people dancing around and singing. There was lighting. There was big crowds.
Yeah.
And so to actually rework it again must be almost a little bizarre. I'm sure you can imagine it.
It's hard. It's very hard to rewrite. Well, I've always known that I can make it better. And in the can stage version, you know, at a certain point, you just have to lock the writing down. And because it needs to.
Yeah. Time's ticking away. Yeah. Sure.
But when you lock it down, you know, it gets locked. So everything is on purpose. And all the threads you weave, you follow up on, and it becomes a kind of like organism. And so to reattack something that was complete in that way has been very challenging for me.
Dora Awards? Did that happen for you
guys? We won some Doras.
You won some Doras.
Yeah, we won six.
Dame Edna, when I interviewed Dame Edna one time, she said to me, "Well, I absolutely scooped up Tonys with my show." And I've been using that ever since.
Absolutely scooped up.
Yeah. So that's funny. You scooped up Doras.
We just were scooping and scooping. We couldn't stop scooping. Yeah. It was crazy.
Fun night, right?
It was. You know, it's fun when you win. It is fun. Yeah.
You're having fun.
Yeah.
Champagne?
Yeah. Lots of champagne. Yeah. But I mean, you can't buy into that too much, because then it has to also mean something when you don't win, and that's a hard trap to fall into.
Right.
But it was exciting, and it was so exciting. Like, pretty much everyone on the team was nominated, and that was we really fell in love with each other doing that show, and it was this really intimate experience, and we were building it all together. So to have that night where everyone got celebrated like that was pretty great.
Yeah.
We got really drunk. Yeah, it was great.
did you treat yourself to something after an experience like that? For me, I'd want to say, okay, I'm gonna buy that coffee maker I've been talking about. Nothing like that.
Nothing like that. It's been a really busy year. Mostly we've just been work and then doing more work and then we do more work.
Right.
But I'm hoping that I'll have a vacation soon. And that's when I'll celebrate the Doras.
When you think about a vacation at this point, is it, okay, I just need a place to totally unravel and relax? Or do you say to yourself, no, I'm going to Paris and I'm going to take in more culture to expand my already expanding universe?
I don't know. I haven't, you know, I haven't even thought about it much. I haven't tried it on.
Yeah.
In some ways, I'd like to just sleep for a month.
Sure.
But in a comfortable place that looks nice.
Right.
But then also, I like exploring. All I know is I'm going to San Diego with Life After, which is very far south.
Right.
And afterwards, I have a bit of time. So I think I'll stay down there for a bit, maybe go further south. And that's all I know.
The freedom of that is, I mean, for anyone who has worked a 9-to-5 and they hear you say that, I mean, that is ambrosia right there. What a wonderful idea to
I know,
be able to go down and just beautiful. Stay afterwards.
Just picturing myself in a visor somewhere pretty, you know. I don't know why a visor.
San Diego, a far cry from the chilly winters of Stratford.
Yes,
growing up.
It's very chilly in Stratford.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good upbringing. You liked it there?
I had a great upbringing. Yeah. Magic. It was great. I look back on it very fondly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's sort of its own little world.
It very much is its own little world.
Every time I talk to somebody who's working there or grew up there, you know, it's just got its own cultural ecosystem and...
Which is works to its benefit and also its detriment, right. I think. I think that soon I hope Stratford reaches more of the world. But but it's a pretty amazing place to grow up, because it is this very unique ecosystem of artists, working artists with their kids. It was just an incredibly inspiring, supportive community of kind of big thinkers. And all my parents' friends were artists too. And there's so many musicians. And I really just felt like this regular... I just thought that's what all grown-ups did, which is kind of a nice way to grow up.
Right. So you and your two sisters, Annika and Eliza, and you're growing up in this place. And so mom and dad so it's the Stratford Festival, for people who don't know. I mean, there's a bunch of theaters there, and obviously in the summertime, classical music and all the rest of it. But you know, the big draw there from spring to fall is Shakespeare, it's, you know, some of the classics, that sort of thing, musical theater. You're all born there. Is mom and dad just doing that before you guys come along, or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing that forever.
Right.
Yeah. My mom worked there. She started working there when she was much younger than I am now.
Wow.
Which I can't even imagine, but both of them had been at it for a while, and then we came along. Yeah, and they work... they'd work, you know, the summers, they were in the pit at the festival and playing fanfares, which is this unique thing at the Stratford Festival where they announce the start of the show with a group of five brass players.
Yeah.
I could sing the whole thing, but right, I won't. Right. And
we got a glimpse there.
Yeah, I'll do it later. That'll be a bonus. And then, you know, in the wintertime, like, my dad played for the ballet, and he played the Lion King for 5 years, and wow, my mom would guest at a lot of symphonies and things. There was just a lot all year round, but.
Right.
Yeah.
And obviously going to school and just doing things that kids do, but I would imagine a lot of time hanging around these theaters.
A lot of time hanging around the theaters. Yeah, we kind of always see everything every year. There were a lot of comps going around when I was growing up. I don't know if it's still that way. But,
right.
But we would really see everything. Our babysitter would take us to see Hamlet again because we wanted to, I guess. And then we'd see specifically the musicals so many times and often sit in the pit for the musicals or just be backstage. I don't know. It was just like a very regular, like our backyard kind of sort crazy.
But kind of a show business upbringing.
Oh,
in
yeah.
In its own way.
Like, I think I'm the only person I know who's seen Man of La Mancha 22 times.
Right.
Like, that's a weird
Would
thing.
Would you go again?
I don't know. As an adult, it's lost its magic a
well,
little
right.
bit. Like, it's, I don't know how I feel about Man of La Mancha anymore. But when I was little, I loved it. I lived for that show.
Yeah. And did you have other friends who also had parents?
Oh, yeah.
This. Yeah, so it was kind of this gang.
Yeah, like I was like best friends with one of the music director's daughters, and we just, it was a whole, there was a troop of us. Yeah.
Right, right.
And then people whose parents didn't work in the theater, everybody still went a lot. It was just kind of, it's a big part of the ecosystem there. It's woven into the fabric of that community.
You point out that your dad, big jazz lover, and so he's, you know, folding laundry and listening to Ornette Coleman or whatever he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, some people might think, hey, you only heard one type of music, but it was, you were getting, a lot was coming at you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we didn't actually, like, listen to musicals at home.
Mm-hmm.
We would see the ones they did.
Right.
My vocabulary of musicals is actually a little limited to the classics, what they did at Stratford. But Dad, yeah, brought in a lot of jazz, a lot of orchestral music. Then I also had two older sisters who were pretty cool, so they would show me cool music.
You know? I was so jealous of people who had older brothers or older sisters who could, you know,
it's
shoot you that
up.
Record and kind of let you know what was good and what wasn't, and even, you know, point out, no, don't listen to that.
I could, you know, the privilege of having older siblings is that, like, in grade 7, I could turn to my friends and be like, have you heard OK Computer? It's crazy, you know?
It was crazy.
It is crazy. It's okay, so good.
but not Kid A, OK Computer.
Oh, all of them.
Yeah.
All of them. Don't. But, you know, OK Computer is the way in.
It is the way in.
It's the way in.
It is the very much the rubber sole of the of the Radiohead arc, where they suddenly are starting to play with more computers and so on.
Yeah, but we should not diminish the power of Kid A. No, it's not one or the other.
It's a sonic, it's a sonic marvel.
There's it's a no sonic other. Marvel, yeah.
But it does, you know, something I hear about, I was talking to Ron Davis on this very podcast not long ago, and he said something interesting about working with millennials, and that is that because of the streaming culture we're in now, for somebody like you who came up with all this different type of music, I mean, it really does allow you to kind of jump around with the tools we have now to listen to music, to listen to Ravel, to listen to a piece of musical theater, if you have to.
I've never really got the cast album thing.
I think after I saw Phantom of the Opera the first time, I got the Colm Wilkinson recording and listened to the crap out of that. And that was the one time I kind of did that. But my brother was a massive musical theater guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he had them all.
Yeah.
It was weird.
They've never made sense to me. I understand seeing the show and then wanting to listen to it, but I know people who can, and I admire that about them, that they can get familiar with the show just from listening to the album, but the pieces that are missing make it feel silly to me. I shouldn't say that. Oh, no, I can't.
A lot of people have not seen Hamilton, but love the Hamilton record.
Well, that one kind of feels like an album, though, you know, and especially because there isn't really any talking in that show. I think I've never seen it.
You haven't seen it?
No.
Britta Johnson has not seen Hamilton.
Well, who can see Hamilton? It's impossible
true.
To see Hamilton.
You're going to New York, right?
Yeah. Do you think I can get into Hamilton? Yeah, no way.
Make a few calls.
I don't know if I'm not important enough to get into Hamilton.
I think you can.
I
think
no
you
way.
Can. I think you should try.
Okay, maybe I'll try. I'll try. But
who knows what that would lead to?
People really try to see Hamilton and they don't get in there. We'll see.
I know.
Have you listened to Hamilton?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like it?
I mean, I like it. I'm fascinated to see it at some point.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting storytelling, I think.
Yeah, no kidding. but millennial culture seems to be able to jump around genres with far more ease it's not as attached to your identity as maybe somebody like me who grew up, you know, grunge came out. That's all we were into for a while. And, or new wave was happening and that was it. And you dressed the part and you did the thing. And I think we've maybe expanded from there.
I think that might be true. Uh-huh. But there is that lost art of like an album, listening to an album, you know, and with a beginning, middle, and ending that I feel like.
Do you do that still?
No, I don't. And I
it's increasingly harder to do.
Unless there's like albums that demand that you do that. But I'm trying to think about even the last time. Sometimes maybe if an artist I love releases something, I'll listen to the whole thing. But even still, I like my attention span has changed.
Right.
What I'm used to, how I consume things.
I think they have rewired our brains.
I think they've rewired a lot of things.
They have, right?
Yeah.
It's a frightening time.
It couldn't be more frightening. Yeah.
Right?
I guess it could be. Yeah, we're going to watch it get more frightening. So I don't know. I shouldn't say that.
So, you know, I love this idea of you kids running around in pits and taking in these shows. And I'm sure on some level it didn't feel that special. It just felt like this was life.
It didn't feel special at all.
No.
Even only now, looking back, do I look at it and say, yeah, maybe that was unique and pretty special.
Right.
That kind of access was a real privilege, definitely.
So at some point, you know, this world is obviously, you're imbibing it, you're absorbing this whole world. And then a very difficult moment in your life. You're 13 years old and dad.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, crazy.
Early.
Yeah. That is the thing that happened.
Your dad passed away, and what was that experience? I mean, was there a lead up, or was there?
Yeah, he died of cancer, leukemia. Uh-huh. So it was a year in total since the diagnosis to when he passed away. So there was.
Did you have any other experience with any of that, like somebody else you knew?
No, only in theory,
right,
from TV, and then you have friends who. But more friends who'd lost grandparents to it mostly,
right,
but not so much. And then I had a few friends who'd lost parents. There's like a club,
right,
that you feel yourself join when it happens.
I mean, on paper, it's so intense and it's a difficult moment in a person's life. But when you go through that process, I mean, it is a process.
Yeah.
And I've been through it a couple times and, you know, you're just kind of in it. When it's happening. And but of course it's happened when I was in my 30s and 40s, not when I was 13.
Well, the thing I feel about it is that I feel like this is a metaphor I've used already in this interview, but whatever. It's like woven into the fabric of your life. There's not an end date to when the chapter of grieving them or the reality of them not being there isn't a part of your identity or your life, and it doesn't ache and it doesn't hurt and it's survivable and it's fine, but that is a part of your journey, and it's a feeling you can visit when you need to.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just always going to be there.
Yeah. And there's not a single day that you don't wish they were there.
Right.
That's just the truth.
Yeah.
And that it's not a distracting, like incapacitating sadness. It's just a truth that wouldn't it be great if he was still here? Yeah.
My dad, it was the anniversary of my dad's death yesterday. And it's sort of, I know exactly what you mean, because I think you feel like I sure could have used him around to talk about a few things.
How long has it been?
Just 2 years.
2 years. Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
That's all right. Fresh. But, you know, at the same time, you just, you know, it's just a reflection of this difficult time that it was during that process and everything that was before that and the sort of weird, you know, murky darkness that you've been in ever since.
Yeah. You know? And I think something I've been feeling now that I guess I'm a fully fledged adult now, although I don't feel like it, but
it's happening, my friend.
It seems like it's just going to keep happening and then I'll be dead. So, I don't know. I'm starting to feel what it's turned into is like, you know, I was 13. I just knew him as a kid. And in some ways that's a gift because it's this untouchable, beautiful. And we were like best friends. We really worshiped each other.
Right.
We had our own shared language, but it wasn't touched by the complication of actually me growing into an adult and challenging him or him challenging me or that heartbreaking thing that can happen to dads and daughters.
You were right on the cusp too.
I was right on the cusp and then he died. So it didn't happen.
Uh-huh.
And in some ways that's a gift because it's not as complicated. My grief has never been as complicated as I think it is for my big sisters. But then on the flip side, now I'm a musician and I'm a writer and I listen to a lot of the music he wrote and I listen to, and I look at who he was and I wish I got to know him as an adult.
Right.
I feel that as a bit of a ripoff. Like I think it would have been great to know him as an adult. Yeah.
That's tough. at that point, is there a certain, because I you know, I know other people who lost a parent when they were younger and suddenly they become, you know, you hate to say it, but there are a lot of successful people that, you know, sort of got motivated to, you know, keep on keeping on after something difficult happened in their life. And maybe they're trying to prove something to themselves or they're trying to fill a hole or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're suddenly motivated to become this busier person or somebody who's got something to prove or what sort of happens? Because, and I say that only because your first musical only happens 3 years later and it's the, the big box story. Yeah. And clearly you got kind of busy after dad's gone and in the ensuing year afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, we're a whole team of go-getters, all of us in my family. We were before and we were after. I don't know if it's anything I could put my finger on, but I do feel myself wanting to grow into someone who I think he would like, because I really respect him.
Yeah.
He has had a really unique view of art in the world, and so I think that drives us all a bit, but who's to say? And then there's that uncomfortable truth that my big opus, the thing that has definitely given me a career, is very much inspired by losing him.
Sure.
So that's just a fact.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that tells
it's
you.
It's a big flag.
It's a big flag. Like, I just wanted to profit off the loss. I wanted to take it and turn it to gold.
Well, it's funny you say that because I did think about it that, you know, you have forced yourself to keep it in rotation in your mind on some level, that you now have to keep taking this show to other places. Mm-hmm. This theme is going to keep coming up. Other people like me are going to ask you similar questions.
Yeah.
You have put yourself in a position in that way.
And as I approach the rewrites, like I've been now kind of neck deep in rewrites to get ready. We start workshopping it again on Sunday, like in a few days.
NYC.
NYC, yeah.
Manhattan.
Start spreading the news, yeah. Every time I'm like, what was I thinking? Why do I make myself return to this? And not just think about it, but like write music about it. Like go to the inner core of my heart. And like, how does this sadness sound? But it's also been a gift. It's like given me a lot of perspective about loss, and that's okay. And I would be thinking about it anyway, so might as well profit off of it.
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching. Capitalism, you know? How can I turn this into money?
Yes. How can I spin this darkness I feel?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, that's art. That's good art a lot of the time, right? That's what people have been doing forever.
I mean, Joni did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody who you love did it. Leonard, I mean, he's the king.
You know, he was just happy all the time.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Definitely. Happy-go-lucky
with
guy.
With his fedora and his... skipping through the streets of Montreal.
It's true. You want it darker. You are listening to Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Britta Johnson continues in just a moment, but first, Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Superframe and superframe.ca. Superframe offers custom archival framing with a mandate to enhance and protect artwork, but not to compete for attention with that artwork. As an art-focused frame shop, Superframe only offers the highest quality frames and materials. They specialize in custom milled hardwood moldings, which they finish in a wide range of stains and lacquers. They mill and stock their most popular profiles in quantity to ensure the fastest possible turnaround, but also are able to design any custom profile with a little notice. Superframe uses woods like hard maple, rift-cut oak, ash, walnut, and cherry, but they're also able to source most woods upon request. Superframe offers water gilding and photo framing, and their services include professional installation, transportation, and display systems. Visit superframe.ca to find out about all the services offered by Superframe, and you can make an appointment there as well to visit their workshop at 100 Geary Avenue in downtown Toronto. Superframe. Check it out at superframe.ca. joniemusic.ca. Now, just a reminder that if you want to become a patron of this podcast, you can head to patreon.com/artattheendoftheworld. You will receive a bonus mini episode featuring Britta Johnson and her top five musical theater picks of all time. And I'm going to send that to you today or tomorrow should you sign up, patreon.com/artattheendoftheworld. The $5 donation level gets you that bonus interview. So let's get back to Britta Johnson. As you know, the theme of this show is to mine the minds of artists for some sort of nugget, some sort of interpretation of the world that we're living in right now. Political divisions, echo chambers, Me Too, appropriation, xenophobia, environmental dread, you name it. And I'll point out that everyone that I've spoken to so far has handled this part of the conversation a little differently. But Britta Johnson, my guest today, had some very thoughtful commentary. I want to play that for you now. Let's talk a little bit about the theme of this show. I think it was somebody who said, in difficult times culturally and politically, it can be a great time for art because it really does get, you know, people say the more harmonious society is, the more poppy the records are going to get and all the rest of it. But if you actually have friction of what we're seeing right now, that helps to create a conversation and it helps to create art on some level. So as the world happens around you, and especially this last couple of years, what goes through your mind as you, being an artist?
Oh, I don't know. It does recontextualize what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And the haunting thing about what's going on right now is that it wasn't that it was not going on before.
Right.
It's that now it's been exposed. And that is a troubling thing for a comfortable middle-class white person, I think.
Right.
But I do think there's a responsibility right now to keep looking at the painful truths. And I do think that art can carry truths as painful and complicated as what is coming up right now for society. So yeah, I don't know if I don't know if that's shown up in my work yet, but it is something I consider. Like, especially music can hold contradictions, and it can say something and feel differently. It can hold a lot of the things, the chaos of what is going on right now. So I do think a lot of really exciting things are going to come out of this, but I still wish it wasn't happening. But
it's fascinating to me that it's easy to complain about social media right now because it's this endless argument that seems to be leading to nowhere. Yeah. At the same time, it also seems somehow responsible for the big conversations, whether that be Me Too or civil rights or the political discourse or whatever. It really has brought things out in the open. Mm-hmm. I have such mixed feelings about that.
Well, and then the other thing that it's exposed, which I think we need to talk about and look at, is the echo chamber that our ideas are going into. The polarization of schools of thought right now is mm-hmm. so alarming. And artistically, I don't know, are we only talking to people who agree with us? We might be.
Yeah.
And that isn't productive.
No.
So how do we change that? And even in the world of social media where we have such easy access to one another, it still feels like we aren't actually accessing one another. It feels like we've got two giant echo chambers.
Yeah, we are forever being shackled to our people.
Exactly.
Right.
And
tribalism.
It's true. It's a yeah. And I do think art has the power to change that, but I don't think we figured out how to do it yet.
Yeah. Whoever comes up with that idea to really reach across the aisle, so to speak, or to kind of touch the hearts of everybody in a way that is respectful to the entire group, that's the key. I don't know how that works.
Well, and especially right now, where it's hard because it feels like the other group, the other that I'm talking about, it feels like a bigoted group, maybe racist group. Like, I don't know if we want to. I don't know what that conversation looks like.
Right.
But yes, the person who figures it out. You should figure it out. Do it through your podcast.
I feel like another element that just popped into my brain is when I used to watch Much Music when I was a kid, or even listen just to the radio, mm-hmm. there was this ability to catch a little bit of everything. You know, if you turned on Much Music in 1989, there was a country show, there was a metal show, there was just regular pop music, there was Canadian roots, there was a little bit of everything. And this sort of fractured cultural landscape that we live in now, where everybody can kind of choose their own adventure, it feels like it's been somehow detrimental to the cultural conversation.
I agree with that. I think that's well articulated.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't usually do that, so.
No, but really, people can curate their experience and their conversations and who they're having conversations with and what they're taking in a way that it's never existed before.
Yeah. Do you think that there might be a cultural issue? Do you go, yeah, I'd like to somehow tackle one of the big issues out there?
I mean,
I guess it'll be a moment of inspiration.
Theoretically. But yeah. Also then that comes, the question is like, why me?
Right.
What do I have to say about this? Like, right. Mostly what I'm in touch with right now is my startling privilege and how little I understand about the ugliness that's coming to the surface right now, because I haven't had to face it before.
Right.
So I don't know if I'm the voice to die. I just need to keep listening. I think I need to, I'm being called upon to listen as hard as I can.
It is fascinating, those who do feel compelled and feel like they have the gumption to actually get in there and get messy with it and say, yes, this is the way it should go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel comfortable enough to steer this ship.
Yeah.
You imagine being that person?
No, I can't. Why? I can't imagine that.
So it'll be indirect at this point, it'll be an indirect.
Who's to say? Yeah. Maybe this is big box story is really going to be the shit.
Well, right. That was a big political story.
Yeah, you know, capitalism. I've said it a few times, but we got to talk about it and how it drives this darkness.
The good thing about capitalism is it never seems to go away
as a
fundamental causing of distortion of what it means to be an emotionally mature human being.
Yeah.
And what it means to be a society and what it means to take care of each other.
Yeah, and what's a commodity and what isn't, and all of that. Yeah.
That's a gift that keeps on giving. That
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're thankful for capitalism. Me as an artist. No, I'm not. But yes.
So big box story comes along. You're 16.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a big box tent store is moving into Stratford. Is that what's going on?
At that point, it was a possibility.
Okay.
We didn't win the fight. Like, much later, it was Walmart. And there was a huge fight when Walmart wanted to come to town that a lot of young people were involved in. And
seemed to be often the case. I mean, there was always a debate about these places when they were first popping up. The Costco's, the Walmart's, the, you know, whatever they might be.
So there was a big debate. All of us and my group of friends had a no Walmart pin, and it was a big, I don't know, like the first cause I got behind.
Did it feel authentic to you? Or did you feel like you were being taken for a ride by, you know, more mature minds?
I mean, who's to say? Obviously, it felt real for me at the time
because
I understood it. You know, I saw the documentary of the corporation, and then I read the book, and then Walmart was coming to town.
You were getting all Naomi Klein up on this thing.
Oh, yeah. But it was something I could understand. It's like, you know, an activism I could get behind because I understood in a tangible way the impact that it could have on things that mattered to me. You know, so that it made sense at the time. And now, as you grow, things become less black and white day by day, and it's more complicated.
There's certain kinds of things that you can only get at those big box stores sometimes.
Well, I hadn't been to Walmart even once until I was like 25,
right.
And I needed a bathing suit fast, and I'm like, here I am, and I needed it, and I'm feeding this machine, and the convenience is meaningful to me, so I don't know what to say. It's just capitalism.
I still have a lot of my day to work with thanks to this accessible bathing suit experience.
Exactly, and I paid like $9.99 for it, and I'm not made of money. You know,
made in China prices, my friend.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's complicated, and we're all complicit in all of that. But anyways, at the time, it felt very clear-cut to me.
Right.
This is good, this is evil, this is bad, this would be good. These are the people I fight for, and these are our enemy, and so my first enemy was Walmart.
And how did you feel the music went? And as far as you were composing and putting together lyrics and working on a story, and how did that feel the first time around at, just a reminder here, 16?
I don't know. There was no expectation. I was like, I didn't know I was supposed to be good at it yet.
Right.
I was mostly goofing around. I couldn't believe I was getting away with it. I like asked the principal if I could get 2 credits to write the show. And she's like, sure. So that was,
she's like, you live in Stratford, of course.
Of course, yes. Take all the credits. Quit science. You'll never need it. But I don't know what it was like. And just to be clear, this show was a farce. Very tangentially political.
Right.
Like, it was like, you could just see how much time I spent watching The Simpsons.
A little waiting for Guffman in its earnestness.
Exactly. Well, no, actually, no, it was so silly. It's like the silliest thing I've ever written. It didn't take itself seriously, even at all. It was about a sales competition in a big box store that was secretly a death trap by a man named Harold Hogg. It was ridiculous.
Right.
But yeah, I just hung out and made myself laugh. I don't know. It's not complex music.
How are the rewrites going?
Yeah, I'm working on it yet. We open on Broadway next month. People are like,
for some reason, it's going to be my biggest success.
My big opus. But still, when I'm in Stratford, people will be like, are you still working on that big box story? I'm like, yeah, I've moved on, actually. But
so that happens. You get your credits, and you get a bit of a taste of having to actually. I mean, at the end of the day, you are still having to put this all together, and that does become the base of something.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
It was an amazing, charmed year doing that show.
Right.
We just didn't know what we were doing. Like, it was insane for me to try to write a 2-act musical, but I didn't know that, so I just did it. Yeah. And it was insane for me to try to direct it, and I didn't know that. I just did it. And,
right.
You know, it was a cast
youth.
Of youth. There's the audacity.
You can do it.
Yeah, exactly. If only I could get that feeling back. I've been trying to chase it for years, but
you have 40, to have it. I think you have to have it.
40 of my friends in the cast, and it was all student-led, and we built it all together, and we got to cut so much class to do it, and it kept getting extended, and we sold out, and we sold out, and we sold out, and people wrote letters to the editor, and then the whole of Ontario Street in Stratford, like, most of the businesses dedicated their front windows to our show. It was just, like, this crazy, amazing, and obviously then I was like, well, I guess this is my life now. I guess this is what I'm going to do forever.
And so it was.
And so it will be.
But I want to touch on something that you just mentioned there, and that is waking up in the morning, facing the big world that you have to now, in the New Yorks and the San Diegos and the Torontos. And you do still have to capture some of that spirit of, yes, I can do this, and yes, I can deal with this tremendous amount of communication and work and, you know, the music and everything that faces you. And at some point in your day, you have to find the strength in your heart to go after that.
Yeah. And I struggle with that.
Sure.
I get worse at it every day, and I have to flag it, because soon I'll have to quit if I keep making it this hard for myself.
Right.
But who knows?
For me, I find I try and say, okay, my heart's not into whatever this is right now. Mm-hmm. So maybe if I just go on with my day and see how I'm feeling, and then suddenly it'll just wash over me. I'm like, you can do this now.
That's something I'm trying to learn. Uh-huh. But often my strategy will be to stay alone all day, pacing the halls of my apartment,
right,
being mean to myself. But I'm getting better. So I know it's like, just go for a walk, Britta, or go read a book, Britta, or call a friend, Britta, make lunch.
How's that experience when somebody says, okay, great, you've pitched the idea, we're now going to say, yes, we're going to go ahead with this. Obviously, there's some elation there. You've pitched it. You've taken the time to present the idea, but then now you have to implement it.
Well, I know.
So it's a tough relationship.
It is. I feel like it's something any creator knows, is that the hit of like the
adrenaline.
The adrenaline when someone's like, you're great, you should do it. And that adrenaline hit immediately turns to dread, because then you actually have to do it.
Right. I mean, Larry David tells that story of being renewed for season 4 or whatever it was of Seinfeld, and literally crawling under a table and just shaking and crying nervously, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Just not knowing what he's going to do.
I can remember viscerally the experience of when I found out we were going to get to do the show at the Old Globe in San Diego, which is a huge opportunity.
Right.
And I felt on top of the world. And
This is life after.
I'd just gotten a haircut. I looked great, felt great. My mom took me out for a martini. I was amazing. And then I walked myself home, and every step that I took, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to let everyone down. I'm going to let everyone down. Like
this existential bog of
despair.
Darkness and murk just took over.
And then the haircut didn't even matter anymore.
It looks drab already.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Oh, terrible. Terrible.
Yeah, truly.
So what an experience with the big box, though. I mean, I love that the whole town gets behind it. But obviously there was something actually political at stake for people, and they were invested in other parts of it besides what it was.
I think it was meaningful to the small businesses of downtown Stratford that the youths were involved in their fight.
So that happens, and really it's not long before you're starting to think about life after, and you know, it's really a couple of years before you're starting to put pen to paper.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I kind of just kept writing from there. I wrote a piece for the Blythe Festival's Young Company that next summer, and then the next summer was when I started Life After. So,
yeah, did you have to do other things to stay afloat financially?
Oh yeah. I'm a great barista.
So. Good barista?
Yeah.
This is a good coffee, I'll say.
I mean, that's just French press.
But, yeah. But, you know. Some say that's the purest form.
You know, there's a huge debate going on. That'll be my next piece. Aeropress versus French press versus...
It's funny. You might be a bit like me that way. I sometimes think like any idea like is expandable.
Definitely.
You get a certain way down the road and you go, I don't know, but... I felt like I could take this for a little walk.
The, like, you know? Professionalization of coffee culture and where that debate
is. I mean, how it seems possible.
We could do it.
Yeah. You talked about the farce of the first musical Big Black Story. Clearly, you're taking a more serious turn at 18 years old with this next piece of musical theater.
Yes, yeah. I was.
And you're going to U of T at this point, too.
Yeah, so I just made a decision to be serious. No, I wasn't like that. I'd always really liked to make people laugh. And then it was actually, I had a mentor. I was working on Life After through something called the Paprika Festival, which is here in Toronto.
Yeah.
I had a mentor named Reza Jacobs, and I remember I brought in a song, the first song I was working on, that was pretty silly. It was like people at a funeral talking about food, and I remember him saying, like, I feel like you could... I think you're hinting at something here. I think you could crack this open a bit more. And then I cracked it open. It was like a flood came out of all these sad songs I've been waiting to write somehow. Yeah.
So it goes through the Paprika Festival and it just feels like it's just a stairway of where it goes from there.
Yeah. Well, I did it at the
Fringe.
I put it on the shelf for a few years. I was just doing school. And then I submitted it in a contest at the Fringe. They have a musical prize. It was the first one. It's the Paul O'Sullivan Prize is what it's called. And I took that draft and I submitted it and we got it. So then I kind of finally fleshed it out.
Yeah.
And then we got Can't Stage from there.
So obviously mining into the loss of your father, but also you needed to come up with a world, I think, that felt removed enough from you and also a bit funny.
Mm-hmm.
When we'd last talked about it, it was in theory in my brain because I hadn't seen it.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I went on opening night and I sat in the very back row by myself and I was shocked. I really was. I mean, it was an outstanding production. I mean, everything about it, the way it flowed, you know, I was very concerned about that Sondheim-y singing lyrics routine that sometimes can be a little tricky. It really worked for me. The story was beautiful. The talent was amazing. The band was incredible. It really did come together in that Canadian Stage production. It was something else.
Thank you. That's very meaningful. Thanks.
Yeah. Now, the story was that the person that the main character loses in the Life After version, he's a larger than life character, but different than your dad.
Very different. Yeah. The whole thing. In fact, I didn't set out to write something that I thought was about me at all.
Right.
Actually, I was just like, I've got this idea for a story.
And you didn't think the kid losing the dad?
No, I didn't even draw the connection. All these songs going up about, you know, the nature of loss before you know how to feel it, and all. And then it was last year. I was like, I think this show's about me. Maybe.
You tried. You gave it an honest try
to
move the needle a little.
But everybody loses. Everybody knows what that is. It's
right.
Not just me. It doesn't make me special. I don't want it at all come across like I think that makes me special.
It is special in the sense that for most people that doesn't happen. I mean, it happens later, you know. It's a like you say, it's a select group.
Yeah.
And you have other friends who've experienced.
And on the flip side, you know, a lot of people I know have gone through much more complicated losses than I did. Mine was awful and hard and totally survivable and simple and clean. And, you know, he didn't let me down before he left me and all of that stuff that complicates it. So I'm just, I just want to have some perspective about that.
Right. And you worked with your sister on that one as well?
On Life After? Yeah, she's been really involved since its inception, actually. I mean, we kind of work on everything together. We're in each other's brains, but she originated the lead role, which is kind of where everything comes out of the brain of this young woman. So she really helped me to develop that. And then as we handed off to a new actress for Canadian Stage, and she got the official title of dramaturg. And she kind of just has sat next to me through all of it and helped to, it's rare to actually write a show alone. So we right. really are partners in it, even though I get all the credit. So.
How's that going though? Is it feel okay? I mean, I can't imagine. I've talked about doing something like this with my brother cause he was a big musical theater guy too.
Yeah.
But then I think about the implementation. I just wonder if we would live through it, you know?
It's complicated sometimes, but mostly it's amazing. Yeah. We really, really love and respect each other.
Right.
And we've gotten really good at telling each other the truth. And so when it's uncomfortable, we can say, and that is amazing. And mostly I just trust her implicitly more than almost anyone I've never known. So that's an amazing thing to have in a dramaturg. It's
right.
the greatest gift you can have when you can really trust someone when they say it works.
Right.
So you can move on. Or you trust them when they say it doesn't work. So.
It's critical we all comply. It's critical so that we arrive at the beautiful part of it.
Let's talk about Dr. Silver for a little bit, a celebration of life. Here, my experience was, I was kind of living in the woods while this was all happening, and I was reading about it here and there, but I couldn't believe that you had sunk your teeth into another project of this size so quickly after Life After. I thought, what is wrong with Britta that she would go ahead and do something that seemed even more ambitious in what it was trying to...
It wasn't so much my choice, the right. timing. The right. timing, I think, yeah. when you're young and a young artist, you take the opportunities that
sure.
you're given.
Yeah.
And I think that we learned yeah. through that. But it was an intense year. It was a fast turnaround, and Annika and I felt that every day.
You were in Heliconian Hall.
We were in Heliconian Hall, yeah.
Right, which is a nice space, and I guess it was fun to imagine what you could do with it.
We had the idea before we had the space, actually.
Right.
We were looking for a space for a long time, or rather the producers were. We would show up when they asked us to, but
right.
I don't want to take credit for that work. But yeah, and then we found Heliconian, and it felt really right. Acoustically, it's so great there, and it feels really intimate, but a bit church-like, so.
And Dr. Silver is an evangelist, is that right?
No, he's a cult leader.
He's okay,
like,
he's
got his own school of thought. That,
right.
That,
sort of an evangelist.
So, well, yeah, but it's like evangelists, you know, that's a thing that's
right.
established.
And he's passed away, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so it's his funeral.
Okay.
We show up at his funeral. Am I obsessed with death? Maybe.
you said it.
It's okay, other people have said it. So dead dads, that really drives you, hey? But yeah, we show up at the funeral of this cult leader. His name's Dr. Silver. You don't know he's a cult leader at the beginning,
right.
but you have a feeling.
Okay.
And the
you give us a
is,
few hints.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The assumption is that everyone who's there is one of his followers. So we don't do a lot to catch you up. It's just, there's a ritual that's been set in motion by his death and we're there to do it. And his school of thought is all around, the worship of music and music as the delivery to the divine and, you know, vibration is the highest power. And a lot of this, like that we kind of co-opted a lot of new agey thought around music and made this guy and then made this ceremony, which is a crazy ceremony.
Earlier in our conversation though, you did mention that music may be as close to church as what you've
well that's why we wrote it
experience
it wasn't
right.
by accident
right
yeah.
Not that new agey after all.
No, really. Maybe I feel like I could definitely end up being a follower of Dr. Right. Silver, although you'll find out that maybe people shouldn't, but yeah.
So you go ahead and do that. And what was the experience compared to Life After as far as how it kind of rolled out? And did you feel like, okay, here we go again?
It was really hard.
Yeah.
It was a really hard turnaround. It was really exciting. We did it with Outside the March and Musical Stage Company. So Musical Stage is one of the producers of Life After. And then Outside the March is a kind of immersive, site-specific experimental company. I don't know. It was great. It was crazy. It was hard. It was the biggest difference is that I've been thinking about Life After since I was 18 years old. It's
yeah.
been a really slow burn.
Right.
And this was like, we wrote a show fast.
Right.
And then people came to see it.
And choral music in this one.
Heavy choral music.
So that's different.
Oh, yeah.
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 How did you get prepared to work with that type of music?
Annika and I always like to make lots of playlists for ourselves. Just to try to figure out, like, what does this world sound like? I will say that Annika's probably the best vocal arranger I know, so I really relied on her in that department.
Right.
I don't know. I can't even remember the inception. It was wild. We had lots of long nights up all night together listening to crazy music and cult ceremonies and religious leaders talking and, you know, kind of strange music from the 70s when pop and religion all kind of, I don't know. It was a, it, we had a time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good year, a hard year, right. But a good year.
Do you see something similar happening for that piece? The way Life After is finding its new legs?
I have no idea. I hope so. At this point, at last year after Life After, there was nothing in motion either. So it all takes time. And I think that Dr. Silver is earlier in its development than Life After is. So our hope is that we could keep developing it and then have another opportunity to keep developing up. These things take time.
Yeah. So do you have something else in mind?
Another show?
Yeah.
Well, there's another. I have this 3-year contract with Musical Stage where it's so 3 shows.
You do have to have. It doesn't really matter whether you have one or not.
Oh, yeah. There's one coming, but I don't want to talk about it yet. Like, it's not baked enough. I'll just sound like an idiot, so I'm not going to.
It's the barista thing? Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. Barista thing, yeah. It's about baristas arguing about capitalism. And it's really annoying.
You know what? What I like is that you're able to keep using some of the ideas that have come into your life. So there you go.
Yeah, that's exactly. Great. Yeah.
So New York next week, and you're going to workshop this thing, and that involves, I guess, just, does that mean kind of dismantling it and putting it back together again? Is that what that is?
I mean, not so much dismantling it because it works-ish.
Yeah.
But I've been going back and looking at some parts that have always got my goat, fixing them up.
Yeah.
Clarification. I've done a lot of, Annika and I have been working really hard this month on, and then I'm going to go in with, there's a lot that isn't working right now in the new draft and hope to work out some of those kinks during the workshop.
And does that mean, so you take it to San Diego, it'll do what it'll do there. And then is the hope, I mean, do you sort of go in the back of your brain like, yes, we'd like to get this off Broadway or Broadway? Or
yeah, I guess no, that's out of your control. If I got off of Broadway, I'd say no. Of course, it's completely out of my control. And I have no expectation of that at all.
Have you talked to the Come From Away people at all?
Yeah, we have the same agent, so.
Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
Have you been able to shoot the breeze with them?
I haven't actually. We're friends on Facebook, but I haven't actually talked to them. I want to.
You should.
Yeah.
Just sort of. My understanding, I was talking to somebody from the Ontario Arts Council the other day. That show started with a $1,500 grant.
Oh, yeah.
From the OAC. How about that?
How about that? Yeah. I mean, who knows? Things happen in mysterious ways. Yeah. And I would love to get the show into New York. That'd be a dream. And if San Diego was the end of the journey, this has still been a dream, honestly.
No kidding. Pretty great.
Yeah.
I am, this year to watch it happen, unfold, and watch the show and talk to you at the beginning of Life After and see where it's going now. I'm so happy for you, and I'm so impressed with your work, and you really are a very, very talented person, and so congratulations with everything that's happened so far.
Thank you so much.
Britta has been in New York City workshopping the new production of Life After, and it gets its U.S. premiere very soon. Previews begin March 22nd at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, California. Opening night is March 29th, and it runs through April 28th. TheOldGlobe.org for info, and you can enjoy it at that beautiful venue if you happen to be in California. Thank you to Britta Johnson. That is it. Don't forget, you can help support Art at the End of the World via our Patreon page. If you donate at the $5 level, two things are going to happen. One, you're going to get the next episode early, before anyone else. You're also going to get a very special bonus feature from the woman you just heard. Britta Johnson will count down her 5 most influential musical theater productions. She'll give you some insight into why she's picking these productions. It's absolutely great. We call it the bonus round. So once again, that's patreon.com/artattheendoftheworld. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory of Music, Salter Street Brewery, Superframe Framing Services, and Red Eye Media. And thanks to you. Thanks for checking out the show. You can get in touch, artattheendoftheworld.com, artattheendoftheworld@gmail.com. If you want to send an email, we're on Facebook. Twitter is @artattheend, and my Instagram handle is @wigdad. Don't ask about that one. It's a long story. Thank you for joining us on Art at the End of the World.